Hello and welcome to Let the Bird Fly, a podcast about living freely in a world given back to us. We're in Wade's office today without Wade. Ben is here, Peter's here, and so is Professor, Dr., Pastor, Reverend Mark Paustian. This is the second time here from Martin Luther College in New Ulm, Minnesota. Could you please say hi? Sorry.
Hi, sorry.
I bumped his mic, that's why. Today we're going to talk about discussing authors.
You know, Mike, that was a pretty aggressive hand gesture that bumped the mic. I feel like since Wade's not here, I should point that out for the listeners.
Thank you. We are here discussing what it means to read authors that have been deemed theologically unsafe. Should we do it? If we do it, how can we do it? That kind of stuff. And maybe we'll get into some of those authors that have been deemed a little bit theologically unsafe for one reason or another. We'll see how the conversation goes. This is a conversation that I think Pastor Paustian and Peter were going to do a lot of talking. I think this is more their wheelhouse than it is mine or Ben's. Plus, also, we are taking this great opportunity of not having Wade here, that we're going to fill the space that he usually...
solid content. Solid content.
Wade is in South Carolina right now for a baseball tournament, and I did see that Ziggy... I saw a video today of Ziggy hitting a stand-up triple, so things are going well. With that, Ben, would you like to read our disclaimer?
This show doesn't speak for our churches, our church bodies, or our employees. Employers. To be honest, much of the time...
Or our employees.
To be honest, much of the time, it probably doesn't speak for us.
We're our podcast network.
We will be thinking out loud a lot, so approach what you hear with a healthy skepticism because, well, as a responsible resident of planet Earth, that's probably what you should generally do with almost everything. If you find yourself getting too worked up, tune out, look around, and realize you're just listening to a podcast. That's right, a podcast. So go live free, friends, and don't let us get in the way.
And speaking of our podcast network, just a shout out to 1517 Legacy Project. We are part of the 1517 Podcast Network. You can find all of those podcasts at 1517legacy.com/podcast. And we're back with the free-for-all, where we wrestle with life's pressing questions, and there's probably nothing more pressing to soccer fans right now than the World Cup. So let's talk about the World Cup. We have some soccer fans in the office, and me. No, actually, I really like soccer. I just don't follow the World Cup, so my take will be brief. However, I wanted to just point out, back on episode 29, we did a World Cup preview. I don't believe I was in the office or in the studio for that one, but it was, Dr. Brown was. So
yep, it was excellent.
If you haven't heard that, you may want to go back and just catch that real quick. Episode 29, you find that at letthebirdfly.com/29.
By this time this comes out, it'll be like the quarterfinals or the semifinals, and nobody will care anymore.
Had the U.S. been officially eliminated, was that the last time we talked about it, or why were we talking about
it? We talked about it because the draw had come out, so we were talking about. So, speaking of which, since the United States is out, we're all patriots here, we would be cheering for the United States if they were in. Let's ask this question, who would you cheer for, or who are you cheering for right now that the United States is not in the World Cup, Ben?
Albania, if they're in it.
They're not in it.
Okay. Boy,
you know, a neighbor of Albania is in it, Croatia. So,
is it?
Yeah, just up the.
Are they still in it?
Just up
they
the
are,
Baltic
and
sea
they won their they won their group.
Maybe you should have picked something that other people knew. So, I'm just kidding.
I'm going with Mexico. Absolutely.
Really?
I'm cheering.
They beat
for
Germany.
They beat Germany, and Brazil had a rough start. Argentina had a rough start. It's been kind of a topsy-turvy, but it's coming back to draw right now with, or chalk, we should say. Argentina made it through, and looks like Germany plays tomorrow, but they probably will make it through too.
Yeah, who did Argentina beat in the last round?
Nigeria,
that's right. Okay. So this was the group that I was interested in because I wanted Iceland to win.
A lot of people are pulling for them. They're like an underdog.
Yeah, and they did terrible. So, but
they tied Argentina the first.
They did well, but that's Argentina was struggling. Yeah. But then they got blanked by Nigeria, and then they lost to Croatia 2-1. So I will say I'm gonna go out on a limb and guess that Wade's team is gonna be Croatia. He seems to be fond of
the Flying Flacians, I think is their nickname.
Is anybody out that is like a big surprise?
I don't think so far. I think there's some teams that may be. I felt that Russia got the easiest draw. They got like Egypt, Iran, and then Uruguay, which is a good team. But like Russia's not that good, and all of a sudden they had like this easiest draw. I thought since it's being held in Russia.
Would you say that like Russians, like the, you know, like, they're hosting it, and do you think that they're like prone to cheating or like paying somebody off?
I'm just saying facts. You can draw your own conclusions.
Like, do you think the draw was tampered with at all?
Right. Like they have like probably that was one of those spinning like bingo machines where they get the draw out of. That's what I'm assuming. Is that how they do the World Cup draw?
Wouldn't those freeze in Russia?
Did you play soccer?
I did.
Like in high school?
Right.
Okay.
You about did. 50 pounds ago.
So I was going to say maybe we should let Dr. Paulshin talk because. You actually have some experience in soccer.
No, I Googled it today. I Googled World Cup highlights today. And I discovered that is the way to watch the World Cup. So my name is Danish, so shopping for a team. I'll go with Denmark, who is playing Croatia next, I think.
Yeah, they made it through.
And they played Japan to a 0-0 tie.
Okay.
It was called the least compelling game of the world, maybe of all time. Neither team had anything to play for. I think the headline was Denmark tries and fails to sing as Russia boos them or something like that. So there's no highlights because there was nothing anybody wants to see again from that game.
Maybe some great saves. I don't know.
I think there was one shot on goal. Neither team had a reason to play even. Yeah. So that's my team.
The problem with the format is those third games in the group stage, you're playing. Sometimes you're playing for a tie.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
No one's. Yeah, that's. You're kind of hoping to play for an upset almost, even if you know if you're out of it, so you don't have that.
In a World Cup in the group play do margins of victory count for anything or not really?
Yes.
They do.
Yes.
Okay. So it's. I mean, you should. So you should try to pour it on if you can.
Right. And not so there's tiebreakers, you know, like there's four or five. And I think like the fifth or sixth one is fair play. So like if you have the least amount of yellow and red cards.
Then you interesting. Yeah.
So it is your advantage not to get those apparently, but it's kind of interesting.
That sounds like such a European thing to do, to have sportsmanship and fair play.
It finally gets down to if it's all still all tied after all like five or six tiebreakers. That's just lots, like who wins.
Yeah.
Like they roll the dice or something.
Flip a coin.
Yeah. I can bring more of my expertise if you like.
There you go.
Yes. So
Japan playing Senegal. Did you see that?
Uh-uh.
They played to a tie.
Okay.
And then the fans on both sides cleaned up the stadium.
Really?
Yeah. And any hope that this was going to carry on to other teams, other countries, were dashed. Like, what's the thought process there?
I don't know. It's just like, they're like Philadelphia Eagles fans. I hear that they're...
The opposite.
Oh, yeah, the opposite of that. Yeah, that's what I meant. Yeah. So you played soccer. Mark, did you play soccer?
A couple of times.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I played just recreationally, and then I played for a year in college because I went to a small college and I walked on, but... I saw Ben kicking a soccer ball around today, and he can still juggle, even with an extra 50 pounds. So, I mean, that was impressive.
Hey, don't make fun of my weight.
Hey, I could never juggle, so it doesn't even matter, the weight or not.
Well, I think we've exhausted all of our knowledge on soccer. So why don't we move?
That was a couple minutes ago, Mike.
Biggest sports event in the world condensed down to 5 minutes of expertise.
You're welcome, world.
Yes.
I think best advice we gave was Google.
So we'll move on to our main topic.
Thank you.
And we're back for our main topic. We're discussing today reading authors that maybe are theologically dangerous, or at least some people think they're theologically dangerous. Let's just say authors that aren't, from our point of view, not Orthodox Lutheran. Should we read them, and with what kind of lens should we read them? That kind of stuff. So, off air, we were kind of talking about this one situation where I had overheard somebody say that maybe we shouldn't read Augustine as confessional Lutherans, and he was quickly corrected, like, yeah, we claim Augustine, but I get the point that so does the Roman Catholic Church. So does the Reformed. Everybody loves Augustine. So
what's not to love?
Right. So can we quote him? Can we read him? So maybe, Peter, you can mention that episode number 4, and then maybe your thoughts you can start
off. Yeah, so episode number 4, way, way back in the time machine. Go back and listen to it for the stilted conversation and audio quality comedy. But it was a good episode. It was one of that Wade and I wanted to do right away. We entitled it Stepping Outside the Fortress. And the idea was that there are things in this world that, especially in the intellectual world, I think is what we were thinking about at least, that are not entirely safe, perhaps, or entirely even beneficial, but that there are things there that are important to get. So the idea is that the fortress keeps us safe, and we talked about how that's important, but that we also need to go outside the fortress into the world, and that we're going to find things in the world that are, you know, sometimes scary and dangerous and all that, but that doesn't have to be a reason to, you know, hole up in the fortress either. So that was the idea. And this is kind of an offshoot of that. It's one of the ideas that, you know, go back just a couple of episodes, episode 63, we talked about what we're trying to do with the podcast. And that's one of the things we want to do, is just kind of bring some of these conversations that we find interesting and enlightening in different ways to a broader audience. So this is a cautionary episode, but it's really not. It's kind of the opposite. It's saying, don't be afraid to spread the wings a little bit. Just always make sure you're grounded, and we'll talk about that, I'm sure, as we go through it. So is that fair?
Yeah, and then maybe just a historical note for Lutherans in America, the second wave of Lutherans in America that tended to come from Germany and settle in the Midwest. At that time, the universities in Europe were deemed a little bit unsafe. They were liberal, and I think that's a correct characterization. And so there was this kind of idea there that if you go to do higher learning, if you go get a doctorate, if you go to these universities, you will be corrupted, kind of thing. And so that fortress mentality just kind of stay in there. The problem with that is you can have, and this is maybe is a little too harsh, but inbred thought, right? You're just talking to each other, and basically you're just reaffirming what you already believe, and you're not being challenged a little bit. So Professor Paulstrom, what maybe we could kick it to you, and what are your first thoughts about this?
Well, I mean, there is something about coming home to safe writers, coming home to Lutheran theology after time you forayed out there, you know, writers you can entrust yourself to in a certain way. But I think we unnecessarily kind of impoverish ourselves. We limit ourselves to our own thinking. I think C.S. Lewis talked about literature in this way, and I think it can apply. He's talked about to see through other eyes. You know, he said, I transcend myself when I do. We demand windows. So I think, you know, I'd just be kind of a poorer man to never have challenged myself with other views, other perspectives, you know, in the safety of text that lets you sort of stand above the text and reflect and so on. And again, always come home, you know, but I think you would unnecessarily sort of limit yourself to your own habits of thought if you never strayed out.
Yeah, and even if you are the fortress mentality, somebody's got to go out there and read this stuff to find out if it's right or not. Somebody's got
to
pick up the book,
the
you know? Right. Someone's got to go out there and sound the trumpet and stuff like that. But maybe if you want to expand a little bit on the idea of maybe a thought pattern that you can get lost into in your own, or maybe what are the advantages of seeing somebody else's viewpoint on a specific topic?
Is that to me?
Yes, to you.
Well, you know, Kierkegaard may come up in our discussion eventually. And what I think about Kierkegaard at his best is he's giving a new terminology to what is familiar theology in some cases, like what is repentance? So repentance is a self becoming a self that it might be drawn to God. And I just kind of love thinking that through. A self becoming a self that is a self relating itself to the truth of God's word is what he means by that, that it might be drawn to God. And I don't know if that's perfectly said or not, but the path it takes my thoughts down in terms of what it means to repent are, to me, invigorating and refreshing. So sometimes to me, that'd be one answer, is just new terms for familiar territory, testing myself against that terminology.
Yeah, and I think especially in Lutheran theology, we have so many terms, we have our own language almost, mm-hmm. That probably writers from outside, you know, other places might not use those terms, but might be getting at some of the same things and be getting at different things, but using completely different language. And that, you know, can strike us at first. Well, you can't talk about that way, because that's, we got a doctrine about this. This is how it goes. But sometimes they're getting at the same concepts.
Yeah, to have a dialogue, you need to know somebody else's language. I had this experience with evangelicals, the term common grace. I had heard it, but never really thought about it at all. And that was just rolled off the tongue. Common grace, common grace, common grace. And I had to stop and think, what do they mean by that? Mm-hmm. And when I stopped and thought about that, there was a window into their point of view, not always what I would emphasize, but I grew and what was revealed in me was some blind spots, I think. Mm-hmm. Not that I all of a sudden start using the term common grace. I don't. I think it's not all that helpful in the end. But having thought that through, that was, like you said, a window into my own blind spots, but also a window to somebody else's viewpoint, and it was helpful.
Yeah, and I'll say that not just terminology that we use, but like you're saying, terminology for someone else, for the apologetic task, which, Mike, you're always railing about that. Evidently, it's something I was supposed to be thinking about. If you don't know the terminology, you're going to be talking past each other. And this is, you know, the great logicians always start out by saying, we have to define our terms, right? We've got to start, let's create a playing field that we agree upon, look at the rules, make sure that the rules are at least close, and then we go. It's not quite the same. It's actually worse than speaking a different language, because when you're speaking a different language, you're just dealing with maybe gestures and tone and that stuff, and that's it. When you're speaking the same language, but you don't know what those words mean and what, you know, the richness that maybe someone brings to the table with something like common grace, you're going to miss the most important part of the argument, at least from the perspective of the person that you're speaking with. So,
well, and I agree completely, and I think it's kind of a labor of love on our part as well that we are willing to wrap our minds around other thinkers and look for what is dangerous as well. I think a lot of our people love C.S. Lewis, and I love C.S. Lewis, but he can do a number on you. If you just immerse in him, you're going to have this whole idea of continually getting better and better. You know, where tin soldiers being made into new men, and the part that's still tin is a part that hates it. And it's built into C.S. Lewis. After you die too, as a good Anglican, that process continues. And I think for a while that really harmed me personally. I would have said that among the most difficult questions there are, almost sort of apologetically, is not hell or suffering. Why am I not better than I am after 55 years of this? And that can really be haunting and sort of erode your confidence. And the last time I was here, I brought up same time sinner and saint. That is the thing that C.S. Lewis doesn't understand. And so I think there is kind of a gatekeeper role to play as well for all those that maybe are not discerning.
Bringing up that concept of symbol Eustace Epicator, which we did an episode on that as well. That was at Mike's house. We actually moved around.
That's when you invited everybody to Mike's house?
Yeah, it worked out well. I haven't done that lately. I should do that again. but that's a concept that I think for Lutherans, especially people who have grown up in the church and really kind of immersed themselves in the theology, that has a ton of significance. And if you don't understand that, it's very difficult to understand Lutheran theology, excuse me. At least from my perspective, when I'm talking with people who are, you know, very theologically educated but not in my tradition, this is the point where I kind of drive to very quickly mm-hmm. and say, you got to be like, you've to understand this, you've got to be okay, at least temporarily, just suspend disbelief, be okay with this, you know, with this logical rub. And then I can tell you why this is so important. You know, I can walk you through the Sadie's passages to get you there. That's mm-hmm. fine. But that's not, I mean, there's something far richer behind that that I want to get to. And so when I think about something like that, again, I think, well, other people have these same moments that I just don't understand. Mm-hmm. When a friend of mine in Texas came up to me and said, hey, I know you've thought about being a pastor. Just wanted to kind of talk to you about that because I'm kind of thinking about it myself. And I thought, oh, okay, we'll have this conversation. And, you know, I don't know what the process would be like for him, but I can kind of talk to him about it a little bit. And then I found out it was just a matter of applying for a job at his church, you know, as a pastor. And he was thinking about doing that kind of as almost like a what we might call a tent ministry or something. He wasn't even going to quit his job. He was just going to kind of go part-time in both places. And I realized, okay, well, this is a different, the terminology is the same, but we're talking about something very different. This is where I then started talking about vocation and how it's really important to be active in your church and different things like that. But the terminology threw me, right? Now, getting into this, you know, getting kind of pulled into his, orb, his sphere, then we were able to have a better conversation.
And then also to think that if you're talking to somebody of a different theological perspective, that you're expecting them to understand your terminology too, or an apologetic to a skeptic or somebody who's not a Christian, you're expecting them to understand your terminology. It's only right that we try to understand their terminology, and then there can be some common ground there. But maybe we can take the conversation to specifically, not necessarily specific authors just yet, but specifically reading maybe C.S. Lewis or Kierkegaard or somebody else. We could list off quite a few. One thing that more and more I think about is, let's take Augustine as an example. We would perhaps like him to be more clear on this topic or that topic. But we have to remember that he's writing in his time, in his period. If he was living in 1530, he would have spoken differently because of the historical baggage and the contemporary situation. And so sometimes we can say, okay, this person is absolutely not orthodox. And that may be true. But to have a little Christian charity and say, well, they don't have the history of the Reformation, or they don't have the history of modernity, or they don't have the history of even, let's say, pre-Nicaea. They don't have the history of the Nicene Council yet. So there may be what we may think they're being a little sloppy in their terminology, but the history of the church hadn't gotten to that point just yet. And so they don't have that baggage. And then to put myself in those shoes and say, if we're here for 100 years from now, and just off chance somebody 100 years from now is listening to this podcast, the only thing that I'm going to put out there permanently, semi-permanently, they're going to be like, how many times are they going to cringe? Not just because they're going to cringe because Wade's here, but cringe, be like, that was a sloppy way to think about it. Well, maybe there was a controversy 50, 70 years in the future that I hadn't even thought about, right? So a little charity, I think, goes a long way.
Well, and I think, too, in addition to controversies and different things in the life of the church that come up that shape the language or refine it or whatever the case may be, I also think those things color the emphases that authors have at given times. I mean, you can even look throughout the Lutheran Church in America at some literature, and you're just, why did a guy write a whole book about this one thing? Well, because it was really something people were going through at a period in the church, and they were really, it was a important topic that people were fighting through, and you just kind of look back thinking, that kind of seems like an odd thing to focus on, or why are they writing it always returning to this central point or this focus? And I think that happens to just, all authors.
I actually just read a book that kind of made me think that it was about Matthias Flacius Illyricus. I was like, why are they writing about this? But it was probably just really important at that time that it was written.
Yeah, so really, I've read that book too.
I don't think it really has anything to do with today. I don't know if we can have any lessons that we can draw from today. Maybe, I don't know.
That's for Wade, right? Yeah, okay. I think I get it. No, I think there's another reason we read these people. You know, if I quote Luther, it isn't that he's the authority over Scripture. It's just he had a way of saying something, you know. Lord Jesus, you are my righteousness. I am your sin. And so you bring up Augustine. I mean, why do you read the Confessions? It's just an achievement of, you know, a theology that just sings. I think he invented a genre, pretty much, what he did in that book. And so that's part of what you would impoverish yourself to is, you know, Lewis, I believe in Jesus like I see him like I see the sun, you know. I see everything by him. That kind of thing is another reason I read these writers, just for the quality of expression that then you, of course, test against true sound theology. But, boy, you'd be missing out if you never walked down that path at all.
And your preaching would suffer too, I would imagine.
Absolutely. My dad in heaven now, he would, of the many things he would tell me, he would say, you can tell a pastor who reads from one who doesn't read. And he just meant the quality of their thought and the freshness of expression and the love for words and that whole set of things that are just another category of why I read outside.
Yeah,
this is one of the things that we miss out on if we don't read Augustine too, right? Is, you mean in his on Christian doctrine, especially book four, this is his whole point, is take what, you know, learn from the, he would said learn from the Greeks, right? But, you know, learn from the academies, from the universities, and take that, because we put that into service for the church. So he's actually making this very, you know, kind of explicit argument there.
Yeah, I love that.
And that, you know, I find it interesting when people don't approach Augustine with an understanding that he's writing at a certain time for a certain, you know, place, because he's the, you know, a rhetorician, you know, par excellence.
Right.
And that he would say, well, you have to consider your audience, you have to consider the situation, all of these huge questions for rhetoric. And then when we don't do that, it's kind of like, well, if you'd read Augustine, maybe you'd understand how to do this better.
He was so far ahead of his time, wasn't he?
Absolutely,
Somebody,
although he didn't know Greek, so shame on him.
Somebody, I think, called it a productive ambivalence with rhetoric. So a suspiciousness about rhetoric, and yet he's the one that ushered in eloquence into the church in a certain way.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, back to that point about preaching, just I think we mentioned this before, or I have, that when I could, I sense myself becoming stale in my week-to-week sermon preparation, probably a month after my people sensed I was getting stale, repeating myself, that kind of stuff, falling into cliches. One reason was I wasn't doing a very good text study. But the other reason I kind of, after a while, started to realize is I hadn't read a novel in a while, or I haven't read a book on history or a biography or something like that. I just wasn't into words. And thinking things through. Sometimes the best thing a pastor can do is go read something that has nothing to do with theology. And then, for two reasons. One is it's a different vocabulary. But also you start thinking about grand concepts in a different way. And the Christian, especially the pastor, is always relating that to theology. And so that's when you start getting good examples and good analogies and fresh words and stuff like that.
Well, we have, what, 2¾ doctors in the room? Peter's like the cool kid. Like, he doesn't want to get his doctorate because everybody else is doing it. Like, it would be really easy for me to finish, but he's just like, I'm not going to do it. Everybody's doing that. So he did all the work, paid all the money, and then he's not going to get the title.
Some people call that foolish, but whatever. I like your spin on it better.
Anyways, with 2 3/4 doctors in the room, I was always the impression the reason you get your doctorate is so you don't have to read anymore.
The reason the number one reason I got my, and by the way, I have a fake doctorate too, so we get the fraction needs to be off a little bit because mine's not a PhD, so we're going to figure out what the fraction is.
Okay.
Wade probably has that in the back of his mind. Yeah. Anyway, the reason I got a doctorate was,
I think Wade's writing a book on that right now.
So that, so it hasn't come up yet, but there is going to be a situation where I get to say these words. I'm not a real doctor, but I'll take a look anyway.
I was just asking my wife if she had seen the doctor about something, if she talked to anyone about something that she needed to talk to a doctor about. And she asked me the question. She said, so now I've asked someone. I said, I mean a doctor. And I thought, you can't even say it to me. And then I said, you can't ask yourself. So, yeah. I think that's great. I mean, that's actually probably the thing that I wish most that I had my doctorate for is all the wonderful jokes.
Yeah, there's a great story about this guy on a plane who was a doctor of philosophy, PhD in philosophy, and in epistemology. So technically he's an epistemologist. So if somebody found out that he was a doctor and he would say, what kind of a doctor? He would say epistemologist, and then watch him try to figure out what part of the body that was. I think that's the toe, right?
That's fantastic, yeah.
Peter's wife actually also has his doctorate, and I really want
has
to be...
She has her doctorate, not mine.
What?
You said she has his doctorate.
Oh, I'm sorry.
She doesn't mind. She has her own.
Has her doctorate. And I want to be able to refer to them as the doctors Hermanson, but Peter is being stubborn and won't finish.
So in your doctoral studies, Professor Paulson, I'm sure you had to read a wide variety of authors that were not Wisconsin Synod Lutherans.
A couple.
So talk to us about that. And maybe there was one that really jumped out and said, that was fantastic. Every Lutheran should read this. Or just your experience in your doctoral work.
And it wasn't in theology, right? So
no.
So you wouldn't, I mean... you're not recommending a theological text to us, but
no,
something we might be uncomfortable with how they talk about communication or something that's
I guess we could walk down the Kierkegaard path some more.
Sure.
If you like.
Yeah.
I mean, you guys weigh in. I'm no kind of expert, but I did have occasion to grapple with him and try to come to terms. So a really interesting guy who has been misread in most circles, I think.
Sure.
And we can talk about the problems that there are with him. So he saw a world in Denmark that was missing what he called, with Luther, Anfechtung. Mm-hmm. It had none of the struggle in Luther's day. Therefore, none of the appreciation of the gospel could be possible. And he just did this fascinating thing about it. He wrote books of philosophy under pseudonym, and he wrote under pen names from a whole variety of positions outside of Christianity. So famously, Fear and Trembling is a book
mm-hmm.
written by a non-Christian pseudonym who just can't make any sense of Abraham willing to sacrifice Isaac, right? Because he's concerned about that story just not keeping anybody up at night. It's, it's too much of a flannel graph. So what he did, he would write books of philosophy from different positions outside of the church. At the same time, he would also write, he called them edifying discourses, books of Lutheran sermons. And the misreading of Kierkegaard comes from most scholars who have not looked at those sermons and have also ignored what he wrote about his own authorship at the end of his life. What he said was, all those books of philosophy were self-canceling voices mm-hmm. designed to show the total bankruptcy of philosophy, designed to chase you to his discourses where his real heart was. And it was to his chagrin that he was famous for the philosophy while he called those other books just like a flower in a path waiting for some reader to come along, right? And you read those books, not that they're perfect by any means, but that's where you have a recognizably Lutheran voice and some writing that you just would love to have written yourself. A whole book that ends in the crescendo of I just love this expression. It is an honor to owe everything to Christ. And there is a Lutheran voice you hear in that place. But so one writer summed up his view on philosophy with the acronym SPUNCA, S-P-U-N-C-A, which just is sophisticated philosophical understanding is of no Christianly value. And that's the thing nobody seems to know that Kierkegaard actually felt. So you can imagine how easy to misread a person who is being that opaque himself on purpose. But he's trying to create Anfechtung or struggle with the simple question of what it actually means to be a Christian. So there may be pietistic problems with him and other things we can look at, but there's way more value there, I think. And others are reaching the same conclusion. A Missouri Synod writer named Mann, I think, has a book called Shall We Then Sin? It's a book about Lutheranism kind of going back and forth between pietism and antinomianism. And he has just a wonderful treatment of a whole series of writers, Bonhoeffer, Kierkegaard. And he's come to the same conclusion. So anyway, that's kind of a monologue on my part. I'm sorry to...
No, it's Peter perfect. Will link that book on our show notes because I told him to write it.
Well, and Kierkegaard, he starts talking about truth and subjectivity. And I would imagine that's where people really get a little bit worked up.
Sure, that's one of the places. When I was first reading, I think, Practice in Christianity, every time I came across the word objectivity, where he was dissing it, you know, I want to throw the book against the wall.
Right.
But, you know, coming to terms with the writer means you figure out what he means by words, and objectivity for him means treating God as an object, treating God as just an interesting thing to talk about, like a shiny coin or a bird. And that's what he means. And so by subjectivity, or truth is subjectivity, it may still be problematic, but what he's trying to say is what is the value of truth if I treat it that way? If I do not take the smallest part of it up into my life and put myself in the categories of truth, what's the point of that? So again, not saying that's kosher, but I'm saying there is a misreading too that happens.
Do we know anybody who knows Danish? Like, it'd be interesting to know what the word he used for objectivity and subjectivity.
I'm not sure about that.
You know what I mean? Like, if there's something
I wonder if
lost
Brewer,
in translation.
Friend of the show, Brewer Erickson, he might have dabbled in it.
Yeah, he needs to email us.
Did you say your last name is Danish?
Yes.
And you're cheering for Denmark?
I am.
Well,
all the way.
I think we nominate you to learn Danish. It can have like 4 or 5 years. We'll have you on again.
Is
that enough? I don't know how long he needs.
I don't think he can have that long.
Well,
maybe it's a hard language.
I'm sure it is. But he teaches Hebrew, so I think he can manage. I don't know if this is for you, Dr. Paulstrin, or if Peter knows this or not, but Kierkegaard and Hegel. Some background on that, and does that really? I'm not up on it enough to know, but I've kind of got the impression that really kind of set him in a certain way. Like he really, that was a big deal.
Yeah.
With Hegel, and he wanted to go in a different direction or something.
Well, he saw what was happening to the church in Denmark, where if I'm Danish, I'm a Christian. I mean, what else would I be? It was that kind of a view of faith. And what he saw was sort of a veneer of Christian language that remains in the church that really is covering up full-on Hegelian philosophy. And that's mostly what he was reacting to against. So, yeah, a pretty bitter struggle between those two philosophies or ideas.
And it's
Peter,
go ahead.
Some doctors are trying to talk about this. If I want your opinion on, I don't know, on the Packers or something, I'll talk to you. But could you let them please have it?
I've got my Brewer shirt on. I prefer to talk Brewers right now.
Peter actually studied philosophy, so he's very knowledgeable. I'm just giving him a hard time because he won't finish his doctorate.
No, so one of the things that's interesting with Kierkegaard and Hegel that I've always found interesting as a Lutheran is that they're both Lutheran, and they both claim that, but in such different ways. And you see a transition with Kierkegaard. He's sometimes called the father or even grandfather of existentialism.
Right.
My guess is that he wouldn't have cared for that. I don't know if someone ever said that to his face or not, but
he, you know, it's his own fault that he's misread. As I said, to read his journals and papers, you will just find him scoffing at the one thing existentialists agree upon, this What is it? Essence precedes.
Essence precedes
existence.
Existence.
So, I think a pretty wholesale rejection of that, and that's what the irony of being thought of as the father of these people.
Right.
You know.
No. But his method is his approach definitely opens up the door to this, and there's a transition that happens. And so, what I see happening with right here within the kind of the Lutheran world, actually pretty close together, right? Denmark and Germany. Hegel was Berlin, I believe, if I remember right. This transition from Hegelian just cosmological like approach to at the highest level, I mean, just to the extreme, to Kierkegaard, who's really taking it and kind of saying, like you said, the unfechtum, like, where's the struggle? Right now, I'm dealing with this. I need to deal with this problem, not Hegel's understanding the spirit and the mind and all of these things. That's all fine and good, perhaps, in its own right, but it doesn't change anything that I'm going through right now. And Kierkegaard, he's an author that's a lot of fun to read because he's real. His struggle, I mean, he puts it out there. He wears it on his sleeve or writes it on the pages.
He's a provocative writer. He peppers his stuff with parables that just continually call the reader into questioning himself and so on. He's just really a brilliant guy, too.
You said a moment ago that, it's kind of his own fault that he was misread. Do you think he maybe didn't... Do you think he thought people would kind of get it and they just, a lot of them just never did? Like somebody who's like, extremely sarcastic and they're just the whole time, doing a whole bit and then nobody picks up on it. You're like,
sure,
well, come on. I mean, I know that's obviously a bad comparison.
I think what he would have said is he saw himself as a correction that him would himself need correcting. So he saw himself as playing a provocative role that would have a cost to it, So it's in his journals and papers, for example, again, where if you think he's just all about subjectivity, you'll find clear statements that the gospel is objectively true, whether anybody believes it or not. But he kind of hid a lot of that in his journals, He begged the clergy of Denmark to just preach Luther's sermons instead of your own, because then you're going to figure out how far away you are, I'm getting off point here. I admire him, for example, for rising above in every way the historical critical stuff. I mean, he just would not entertain any thought that the scriptures were anything but what they claimed to be. Just think of his time and place. There's things like that, and there's just insight. I love... He talks about engaging the scripture. I think it's the epidemiological approach, which means to catch the mood of the text like a disease, like a contagion. And if you're not doing that, then you're being abstract. Then you're speculating.
Yeah, that's interesting to think about that, too, within the context of scriptures, which, depending on your tradition, is 66 or some more books, but a lot of authors, right? A lot of different contexts. And so to catch the mood of any one of those texts is, it's a project.
Definitely.
And it's ongoing.
Maybe we could talk about existentialism just a little bit, and then Kierkegaard's, his unfectum, his kind of take on that. So you guys can correct me when I'm wrong, but what helps me think about existentialism is existence over essence. And so what defines me is not so much this abstract human being called Mike Berg that is a professor or whatever, but my existence, my history, the choices that I've made and I have not made. And so what is mankind? Not this ideal man out there in a Platonic kind of way, but we're all, by our choices, making what mankind is, right? And so that's always been helpful to me. But it seems like Kierkegaard means that much more personally. And so, fair or unfair that he's the father or grandfather existentialism, I got to think that he's no Sartre. He's no, there's something else going on there. I don't know if you guys have thoughts about that.
Yeah, I mean, so I am not an expert on existentialism, so don't take this.
You're not an expert on anything until you finish that
that's
thing.
That's right. And that's how I like it, Ben. But one of the things that I see is that, I mean, you bleed from existentialism into some of the, early postmodern thought, like the like Heidegger and Husserl and these, and mm-hmm. and you see that coming kind of to a head there. But before you get there, you get to Nietzsche, and Nietzsche says something I want to just kind of point out and kind of highlight this, the importance of that existence and that history. Nietzsche is, again, this interesting in philosophy, you have these Lutheran philosophers, and then you have these philosophers who grew up Lutheran, Nietzsche, Kant. I mean, these are big names. These are important people, influential in
all the bad philosophy comes from Lutheran, Lutheran, usually sons of Lutheran pastors, you know, so it's, just a warning
yeah,
out there.
Yeah, that's right. and so Nietzsche is kind of reacting against, some of the pietism in Germany, if I remember correctly, but he's brilliant. And one of the things he comes and says is, if he can't accept the idea that I'm going to get too deep here, but I'm sorry, he can't accept the infinite regression, right? And this is Aristotle's concern. This is Thomas's concern. This is everyone's concern, because we can't understand that. But then he embraces it, right? I mean, so he kind of flips it around in itself, and he says, so if everything always exists and it's always going to exist, then this very moment will happen again. It absolutely has to. It's a logical necessity. And then he finds his ethics in here, this point where you have this void, what, you know, the nihilism, the nihil. He finds his ethics there and says, so if it's going to happen again, then I own this moment. I'm responsible for this moment. And so now I have to take responsibility for it because I know it will happen again. And so I need to be the best, you know, Friedrich Nietzsche that I can be, or whatever, however you fill that question in. And that's not a small question. But this is all to say, even in those moments where you're kind of running away from in existentialism, running away from what we might, the grounding that we might really see as essential to a Christian worldview, you still have those big questions dogging you. And there's ways that we're trying to find that out. That I got so far afield. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I don't even remember your initial question.
No, I was just, you know, the textbook definition of existentialism. And then you hear Kierkegaard is the father of existential or the first existentialist or whatever. And it seems to me that those aren't the same. And my question mm-hmm. is, why not? And what is the difference? Is it a misreading of Kierkegaard or how, you know, I remember one guy that Lutheran that I highly respect said, not all existentialism is bad. You know, we kind of mm-hmm. get this. Well, you're the existentialist. Oh, they're terrible. And then who are they? Well, I don't know, but I know they're terrible. In Kierkegaard is part of that story, but I don't know that I have put my finger on it.
Yeah, so now I remember why I went down that road. The idea that existentialism pushes towards nihilism is kind of what I was trying to get at. Mm-hmm. And that even in that, you know, there's these big questions that remain. And I think that's why we are uncomfortable with that, because we see these questions that seem to push towards nihilism, whether they necessarily do or not, I think is certainly an open question. And we look at Kierkegaard and we say, well, clearly he's not a nihilist, right? I mean, he's pulling us back, in fact, saying, you know, be here, be now, because of what God does for you. And this right. is, I mean, this is farthest from nihilism you can imagine.
The degree to which Kierkegaard was obsessed with the person of Christ mm-hmm. Is sort of part of that little known feature of Kierkegaard, but that's like all you can think about when you read certain of his volumes, you know. I feel like I haven't yet explained why I read him or what I like about him. And that's what the episode is about. The quote from Kierkegaard that gets under my skin, it goes like this. He said, "What good would it do me to construct a world in which I did not live, but only held up to the view of others?" And he's talking about the full beauty of Lutheran theology. What good would it do me to construct a world in which I did not live, but only held up to the view of others? And, you know, you could hear a little bit of his dad was a severe pietist. You can hear something of that, perhaps, the concern for taking a little part of this up into my life and actually finding out how different life is with Jesus. But I take that quote in the best way, or try to. Kierkegaard, it's like he was asking questions about communication 100 years before anybody else was, talking about just the terms of receiver and sender and that vocabulary, just wildly ahead of his time. And for me, it's just kind of the questions that he asked. So the main question he's asking, I think, that produced this wild program of producing books in two streams, like I mentioned, is just how to communicate. What does it mean to communicate Christ? And especially, what does it mean to communicate to a culture that thinks they already know? What does it mean to communicate when people are in an illusion? To communicate when people are resistant and not at all disposed to listen because they already know? And it's just such a timely and interesting question, you know. So my dissertation was all about that. It was all tracking that idea in the Old Testament. It's just one way to talk about why story and so on, why all these, the wild variety of forms. And so I opened my dissertation inspired by Kierkegaard. It's just a story of Nathan and David. How does Nathan communicate to David? When David knows the truth, he knows what he did, but he doesn't hold himself in a genuine relation to the truth. So Kierkegaard or Nathan found a way to bring David into contact with the truth that became suddenly unavoidable. And so that's my thing, is whether Kierkegaard is safe or not, he's not. But the questions that he was asking, to me, are very, very timely questions for our day.
Yeah, maybe to broaden just a little bit for a moment, and then we can go back to Kierkegaard, because I want your take on his love life before we end this episode. In apologetics, we kind of deal a little bit with the so-called new atheists who aren't so much new anymore. They're starting to die. I found them refreshing in a lot of ways, because they were cutting through the you-know-what and asking the correct questions. So when they would, for instance, say, Christianity is not a benign thing. You're lying to your children. And most people would just be aghast at that. How could you say that? And he sees this kind of therapeutic moral deism, a phrase that we use quite a bit, this idea that, the truth is not Jesus' resurrection, his death, justification. Okay, yeah, those are fine. But like you said, that's a reality that's somehow distant from me. I'm not confronted mm-hmm. with that. And Christianity, for a lot of people, I think in America, and religion in general, maybe, is this is my therapy. This is something that this is the tie that binds us together. It is something that touches my spiritual side, blah, 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 blah. And it's no big deal. And they're cutting through and saying, no, if this is not true, then you should not believe it, and you're lying to your children, and then list off all the things that Christians have done that's evil. And to me, they're speaking St. Paul's language in 1 Corinthians 15, mm-hmm. right?
Absolutely.
And so there's and obviously that Kierkegaard's not like the new atheist theologically and stuff like that, but somebody who is deemed unsafe, or maybe is unsafe, says some things that are wrong. Don't we all, by the way? But
that's why we've got our disclaimer.
That's right. But
why doesn't everyone do a disclaimer?
Asking the right questions,
putting a disclaimer out,
and hearing people ask those right questions from a different point of view is so very helpful to mm-hmm. me. And then I understand their viewpoint a little bit more, and then I am able to, if it's wrong, combat it in a healthy way, I think. Anyway.
Should we talk about a little bit Kierkegaard and apologetics?
Sure.
I mean, for listeners that, have been told Kierkegaard bad, I mean, the other thing they probably heard is the leap of faith issue. And that's saying Kierkegaard's okay on this, but he never said leap of faith. What he meant by the leap was that there's no gradual path of reason, that you just reason along and all of a sudden you're there. No, you're going to come at some point to the scandal. The ultimate scandal, who Jesus is and claims to be, and so on. In Practicing Christianity, you can read 50 pages straight of Kierkegaard saying no one comes to Christ unless God himself draws him. So not saying he's, again, totally comfortable on that issue, but he's probably goes all the way on the other end, perhaps, to be a fideist. I've heard you talk about that. I mean, Kierkegaard called apologetics a second Judas kiss. And that kind of messed me up for a while as I kind of maybe bought in too much. What he's saying is that arguing for Christ can mean instead you're actually arguing for a view of reason, that is total enlightenment and, you know, modernity view. And so he goes all the way and just, and that's what he means by leap of faith. I think you probably would call him a fideist, where he's just going to say, you just got to believe as God reveals himself to you, which is, I mean, I get that the truth is not grounded in our wonderful powers of reason. I get that, how important that is. But I've heard you talk, Mike, often enough about how the apostles really speak about Christ. And so Kierkegaard was not right about that.
Well, another point just with Kierkegaard on the leap of faith in Fear and Trembling, he brings it up and he's talking about it. Obviously, that's the central one. Do you know who the pseudonym is for that one?
Johannes Silentio or something.
Silentio, so yeah. So like John the Silent.
Who can Abraham talk to when this is presented to him by God, right? So
Yeah. So again, the whole thing of Kierkegaard's pseudonyms just make it really fascinating. And mm-hmm. you know, when you read Kierkegaard, and you should read Kierkegaard. I encourage people when they say, "What philosophy should I read?" If they are Christian, even I tell them, "Well, you might like Kierkegaard, but you've got to read a few things, and you know, read about him too." But he's very accessible. In the Fear and Trembling, though, he talks about the leap of faith. And one of the things that he's driving at is that the main character, he gets to the point of what he calls infinite resignation.
Right.
But he can't get to the leap of faith. So he understands everything up to this point, but then he basically says, but this last step doesn't make sense, and I can't do that.
Right.
And this was actually, when I read it, it was really comforting to me. I thought, yeah, you can't. But as Lutherans, that okay.
Right, we've been told since we're little that it's okay not to understand.
Yeah. Well, and we've been told that faith isn't your work, right? My faith doesn't grow because I'm such a wonderful person. My faith isn't there because I'm such a wonderful person. When when a child is baptized as Lutherans, we believe that faith is being worked there, not because the pastor is a great person, not because the mom and the dad are perfect.
They're not.
Not because the baby's, you know, innocent, but because God tells us that the Holy Spirit works there, and we don't understand that in that same right. moment, in that same way. That's how I always appropriated that leap of faith was, of course there's a leap of faith here. This doesn't make sense. It's mere water and mere words. Same thing with the sacrament of the altar, same thing with absolution, same thing with preaching. The whole life of the church is built around these moments where we are called by God to believe it. And then he even tells us, but you can't. And this just gets to be so Lutheran. He says, so now go and do it. And this is where the work of the Holy Spirit is, you know, underplayed in the Lutheran church, and it's misunderstood oftentimes in a lot of evangelical Americanism. Mm-hmm. But it's so terribly important, because that is the leap of faith. It's easy then. We don't have to do anything. But then people will say, well, what are you saying here? Yeah, right. Yeah. You must be an antinomian and all kinds of labels that get thrown out. This is the problem. I would say it's just a problem with language. We can't capture this gift of God in language, and so we muddle around it.
You said something that I thought was interesting, to bring it back to what we were talking about earlier. Part of when we're talking to other people and trying to understand where they're coming from, I mean, yeah, this idea that there's this stuff we can't understand, for those of us in this room who were born and raised Lutheran, that's really might not hold us up that much. But we have to understand that when engaging with other people, even other Christians who are sincere Christians, that might be a huge hang up for them. And, you know, we would never want to dismiss them by saying, well, okay, what's your problem just accepting this because, you know, it's what Jesus said, it's what the Bible says. There are sincere Christians out there, true believers, who don't think that way. And if we just, you know, kind of in our dialogue with them, assume that about them, they're going to say, well, wait a minute.
I think it's very helpful in those situations to have a very gospel answer, which is to say, whatever God demands of you, he gives to you in Jesus Christ. So there's plenty of places where he says, be perfect. Clearly, yes. That's not possible. But
that's actually a pretty God is my loud and clear message
right.
in the Bible.
So
right?
it you know, if you say it that way, say, well, he also said, be perfect. Sure. And then say, it's the same way. Believe, knowing full well we can't do it on our own, so he gives us the faith. There's quite a few different places where he gives us demands, knowing full well that we can't do it on our own, and then he gives us whatever God demands, he gives to us in Jesus Christ. I think is that's the best gospel answer to people who are struggling with that, I think.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. I've never had it summed up that way, but that's a great mm-hmm. and little line.
Back to Kierkegaard, too, a little bit. He's living, and to that idea of people having some charity of people, and he's living in the first half of the 19th century, right? Mm-hmm. Where, like you said, he's ahead of his time when he probably the postmoderns like him too, I'm sure. the height of this kind of, like you said, Hegelian philosophy, and it's, to understand where he's coming from, apologetics in his point of view is probably not exact parable what we mean as apologetics, and maybe he is getting, it always fascinates me that St. Paul in his writings calls Jesus Christ that scandal, mm-hmm. the stumbling block. I mean, you're faced with it, and there's no, it just does not make sense. The cross does not make sense no matter what angle you go at. It has its own internal logic, but it just does not, he's a scandal that you can't get over. At the same time, he can say, Jesus rose from the dead, and if you show me the dead body, I'm not going to believe it, right? And so there is that balancing act's not the right word, but he understands faith is faith, but it's not grounded in the faith itself. It's grounded in the actual facts on the ground.
Mm-hmm. Sure, and that, another way to say that is that the faith is not something that lives only in the ether, that it actually really did happen. And I think that since Wade's not here, I'll say, Mike, you might find this interesting. I would say that it's very physical. And we see that in the incarnation, right? But what is Wade's thing about incarnation? The chili con carne, right? With meat, yeah. Right. Taco Bell, Latin, whatever he says. So we see it. It's not something that just happens. And this is where, again, we get to that struggle. We get this kind of pull back and forth, and we don't know exactly how to, we can't pin it down. And so we feel like sometimes we're speaking out of two sides of our mouth. And like Ben says, like, well, of course I don't understand it. If you grew up Lutheran, that's been beaten to your head for a long time.
Embrace the paradoxes.
Time, right?
Yeah. Well, we're at about an hour, and we're going to hopefully continue this conversation into a second episode. And to tease you so that you come back, I promise that we will start off with, at the very least, we will get to Kierkegaard's love life. But maybe if Dr. Paulshin, if you had any last concluding thoughts at all you wanted to before we go into the next episode.
Yeah, I suppose one writer put a picture in my head of Kierkegaard being performed in Denmark today by, one man kind of guy, one man theater kind of guy. My words are not coming to me right now, but describes
one man show.
One man show. That why was that so hard? One man
show. Well, isn't one man show like what we call Wade sometimes? What he thinks he is.
But the picture of an audience, pin drop silent, fascinated by Kierkegaard, or rolling in the eyes laughing. And when you know what his subversive thing is, I mean, I've become convinced he just wants to communicate Christ. There's just something very intriguing about that. As far as reading Kierkegaard, I mean, there was one book that he changed, I think I have this right, changed to a pseudonym at the last minute, called, I think I mentioned it, Practice in Christianity. And the idea was, this book was the real Kierkegaard describing what it means to be a Christian. Just at the last minute, he wasn't sure he's ready to put his name on it, as if he had aspired to live that enough to put his name on it. But I think that's an example of an accessible read of Kierkegaard, and safer, I think, less disturbing. Not that it's easy.
Hint, show notes, Peter.
And not that we're endorsing it. I mean,
right?
Yeah, not fully. But there it is.
We've got a disclaimer on our website too. I know. So it's all
that was my
fair
personal
game.
Disclaimer. Yeah. I don't care about your show. It's
yeah,
me.
That's right. Well, thank you very much. We are going to continue this conversation, and we'll probably touch on Kierkegaard, maybe Bonhoeffer. We'll see where the conversation goes. So thank you very much, Dr. Paulshin, for coming on, and we're going to have you on for the next episode, Peter.
Yeah, and you'll have to, but we'll have the conversation soon, but you'll have to wait probably a week, maybe more, who knows,
that's
these
right.
days. But
the teaser.
The teaser, yes. But in the meantime, let the bird fly.
Every evening when the sun goes down, get my party and I begin to cry. I
I don't care what the people are thinking. I'm not drunk, I'm just a drinker. I set them up another round. I set them up another round. I set them up another round. One more round won't get me down. I don't care what the people are thinking. I'm not drunk.